Welcome to the FRSNU podcast with Reverend Rebecca. We're glad you're here. This week, Reverend Rebecca walks back in time through the history of our beloved steeple, church, and community, way back to its beginnings. Her sermon is titled, The Iconic Steeple. Have a listen.
So I first experienced our beloved and majestic steeple when I was here visiting as a prospective minister last February. My husband and I arrived to town a little early, and we were immediately drawn to its charm and its majesty. I remember driving down the street from behind and trying to get photographs, you know, with no one seeing, and anyway. So we were walking back to the Garrison Inn after dinner on Saturday evening. We had spent the weekend here with the search committee, getting to know each other and discerning if we were the right match. So dinner is over on Saturday evening, and we're walking back from Agave Restaurant to the Garrison Inn, and we stopped almost exactly where I can see through these doors on the sidewalk across from the church. It was dark, as it would be in February at that time in the evening. And the steeple was magnificent. It was lit as you know it to be. It was beautiful. And there was also something about it that was even beyond words. So we stopped and we were looking up at it, and I asked my husband if he thought it was safe for me to take a few photographs. And he laughed at me, as he's apt to do, and he said, "Of course. No one is watching you. Go ahead." So we did. So we stood there snapping photographs. It was only a few months ago, after I had been called here and had been serving as the minister for a bit of time, that I learned the other side of that story. In fact, we were being watched as I took those photographs. Sophia Lyons, one of the search committee members, was driving home herself from dinner down the street, and she saw Bart and I there, gazing adoringly up at the steeple. And as she tells the story, as soon as she saw us, she slunk down really low in her seat so she could get as close to the steering wheel as possible without being seen. And then she immediately pulled over to the side of the road and called the other members of the search committee to let them know what she had seen. And she said, and I quote her, "I think it's a good sign, don't you?" So it is an amazingly beautiful steeple. Indeed, this church building, its steeple, and the weathercock do have quite a history in this town. And it is my honor to share just some of those highlights of that history with you this morning. I want to note from the start that I will not be discussing the most recent steeple restoration, although it is clearly an essential part of history, and I am sure that sometime, maybe 100 years from now, some minister will be telling our story. But this morning, I'll be focusing on the times before that. And before I go any further, I wanted to thank some people whose work really did lay the foundation for this service. Linda Tully's research on the steeple was invaluable. She gave me this folder of articles and things that I had this gift of time with this cold this week to just immerse myself in them and to read every single word, and it was fantastic. So thank you. John Steves and Bill Hinahan met with me in person and regaled me with stories and history, bringing it all alive. And of course, the two-volume history books of this congregation, written by Minnie Atkinson with input from Ann White, Cody Frazier, edited by Lindsay Cavanaugh and Pat Skibbe, were and always are critical to my learning. That's where the story came from earlier. And finally, I wanted to thank Les Ferlazzo, because it was Les who took me on an impromptu visit to the Old Newbury Museum, to what he calls the HISS, and introduced me to the weathercock. And he introduced me to the weathercock, and I must say that we were at his home and visiting about other things, and he said, this came up in conversation, and he said, do you want to go and actually see it? And I said, well, sure. So we got in the car and we went over and I went up, and the exhibit is not yet finished. It will be soon. And it will be a part of other things unique to churches at that time. And I knelt down on the ground and got really close to this weathercock. And I was like, this thing has a personality. Like, this is not an inanimate object. I don't know if it's because he saw so much, or she did, over all those hundreds of years. But later, talking to the executive director, I said to Susan, I have to be honest, it has a personality. And she goes, oh, I know, we talk about that. So that is now its home, and it is a win-win arrangement that guarantees its long-term safety and care and well-being. And thanks to an anonymous, generous donor to the Historical Society, also allowed us to nearly complete our fundraising campaign for the most recent steeple restoration. So, excuse me, this church has been a haven for people in this city for nearly 300 years. Its original building, built in 1725, was in Market Square. And when the church outgrew that space, it built this building on what was referred to at the time the stone lot. And indeed, the lot was on a pile of stone. The story is it's the only space left available that they could build. Reverend Lawrence Hayward, minister here from 1905 until 1948, wrote, and I quote, that the ledge that is under this building runs down to Market Square and was actually the foundation of the old church. I wonder if that's true, but I think it's pretty cool if we are built on the same stone as the foundation of our original church. The new church, this building, was completed in 1801 for $26,750.10. No one is sure of the architect, although legend has it to be Timothy Palmer of Salem, who built the Essex-Merrimack Bridge in 1792. On October 2nd, 1801, the whole town marched from the site of the old church to dedicate this new church building. What an image, what a beautiful image that is. And the church is indeed the oldest intact church building in Newburyport, and has had its fair share of restoration activities. It was really amazing reading through building committee reports from 1958 through the 2000s. These included, among many other accounts, a complete, very complete detailed ledger written by Vincent or Vinnie Wood of all the work done during his time here. Everything from building a computer desk to fixing the steeple. There was a report from Jim Kidd in 1990 highlighting the replacement of floodlights in the steeple with less than half of the electrical wattage than had been there, and so many other accounts. The last time that the steeple fell into a state of complete disrepair was in 1946. So 1946, it was found to be falling down. And it was going to cost $30,000, and it did cost $30,000 to repair it. Now, this was much more than the congregation could handle at the time. The congregation was a smaller congregation at that time. It was also a difficult, sort of lean time in the economy of the city. So it was actually removed from the church for 3 years. Can you imagine this building without its iconic steeple? I have a hard time doing that. But putting this into context, $30,000 in 1946 would have bought you one of the mansions on High Street. So similar to what happened in our most recent steeple restoration project, the funds were eventually raised to restore the steeple. However, it was a collective effort of the entire community. They ran fundraising tallies in the Newburyport Daily News. We have images of that listing in the newspaper of how much had been raised. It was truly a collective effort. And then, in addition to community support, the church used the proceeds of the sale of their building that had been called St. Peter's Chapel that was located in the south end of town, this having been used for religious education. And lastly, the American Unitarian Association also gave the church a $10,000 interest-free loan. I should remind us that, so the merger of Unitarian and Universalism happened in 1961, so the history and the time I'm speaking of now and until that time, this was a Unitarian congregation. The congregational fundraising for that 1946 to 1949 time period was led by John P. Marquand. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of him, but I got really, really drawn into his history. Fascinating. He was an active member of the congregation and a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He was the great-nephew of Margaret Fuller, a Unitarian and very influential member of the Transcendentalists. He lived with his aunts in Newburyport after his family had lost their fortunes. And his writings were almost entirely satires about upper-class life, with specific focus on New England. The one that won the Pulitzer Prize is about Boston and the elite in Boston and his thoughts about that. So I found, much to my delight, as I was reading about him elsewhere, I thought, oh, I wish I could find his actual speech that he delivered to start this fundraising campaign. And what, to my wondering eyes, should be in the big folder but was his actual speech. So I read it. His speech was entitled "The Spire Above Yankee City." And this is what he gave at the start of the fundraising. I won't read the whole thing, but there was a few little lines I wanted to share. He said this about the steeple. He said, "We must not consider this building solely as a religious edifice, but instead as what it is also, a work of art and a monument to the spirit and thought of the age which conceived it. In the balance and simplicity of everything around us, there is a sense of serenity and a reminder of a spirit that rises above mundane things. Something of that spire belongs to all of us. And so it is much more than the property of any single religious sect. Indeed, this church is a work of art." Now, one can't talk about the history of the steeple without talking about its weathercock. Proud up upon the top of the steeple, some, and there are varying accounts of this, by the way, but I'm going to land on 56 feet off the ground. I read everything from 54 feet to Benjamin Franklin, who I'll talk about later, who said it was 70 feet. So I'm learning about history as I'm studying this, that there are multiple stories in any history. Let's say it's 56 feet off the ground, is the weathercock. It is a gilded sheet copper cock weather vane. This is now the one that is the Historical Society, but it is a gilded sheet copper cock weather vane, 31 inches high, made of gilt sheet copper and iron. In Tempa Pagel's report to the Massachusetts Historical Society, she stated that the cock was taken down at least 5 times, including adding new copper balls and shaft in 1939 and regilded in 1839, 1857, 1880, and 1949. Subsequently, it was regilded again in 1998. There's one record that we have that shows payment for the regilding in 1857. And what do you think that cost? When I asked some friends, I got quite varying answers. To regild the entire thing in 1857 cost $20. Longtime member Cotty Fraser wrote that the weathercock sustained significant challenges, including the horrible fire of 1811, the 1938 hurricane, and the blizzard of 1988. What's interesting is that its maker has been a mystery until very recently. So it was unknown who actually made this weathercock. The name of the person who had created it had worn off in the elements, and for a long time, folks thought it had been brought over from Europe. So I read several things from previous ministers who told that story. And not only was it brought from Europe, but they knew not where in Europe, but where the other three weathercocks were in Massachusetts that were brought over at the same time. There was quite a story. However, this continues to evolve, and more recently, experts identified it as clearly having been made in America, and that it's American folk art. They thought at the time that it was possibly made by Thomas Drown. Most recently, Susan Edwards, the executive director of the Historical Society, confirmed through an article in the Newburyport Herald, written in 1839, that it was actually Thomas's father, Shem Drown, who made our weathercock. I believe the mystery has been solved. Now, the way she knows this is that based on the date of the article and the birth date of Thomas Drown, he would have been far too young to have designed our weathercock. So this designates it as only one of only five weathercocks made by Shem Drown. Shem Drown was actually a tin maker, and so this wasn't really his long-term work, and I would love to know why he got into it when he did, but he made five. Ours is now one of them. The others, they're quite famous throughout Boston, and they include the rooster that is on the top of the First Church in Cambridge, the one that is on Old North Church in Boston, the grasshopper on top of Faneuil Hall. Like, wow, that's like, now that's pretty amazing. And his very first one, which was the Indian Archer, which today is in the front hallway of the Massachusetts Historical Society and likely was taken from the Indian that is on the seal, Massachusetts seal. So you just have to entertain me for one moment as I digress with a bit of weather vane history, because I just think this was fascinating. It is recorded in Charles Clamkin's extensive book on the history and meaning of weather vanes that the earliest weather vane on record was built in Athens during the first century, and it sat atop the Tower of the Winds. Then, in 973, the Pope declared that the symbol of any weather vane had to be a rooster. Why? Because it reminds everyone of Peter's betrayal of Christ, as told in the Gospel of Luke. Maybe familiar to some. I tell thee, Peter, the cock shall not crow this day before thou shalt thrice deny that thou knowest me. So Clamkin went on to write that the rooster was a reminder to people to not repeat that sin and to come to church. It was also an appropriate symbol to remind people to pray first thing in the morning. They were used on Viking ships, and from the logistical point of view, for the longest time, weather vanes were truly the only way people had to predict the weather. So if the wind was blowing east, it was going to rain. So I have now been watching what way the wind is blowing for days. Perhaps the most famous story that is linked to our weather vane and steeple has to do with Benjamin Franklin. And it delighted me to learn that this is not a myth or folklore. It is indeed a true story. For when I heard it, and this was something that a friend of mine said when I was telling all this stuff I was learning and telling them about it, and then I said, well, then there's Benjamin Franklin. They said to me, oh, come on. Like, really? Well, yes, really. So Benjamin Franklin confirmed that lightning is electricity from an experience with our steeple. This is true. So I'm actually going to read a paragraph of his own words. So this is these are Benjamin Franklin's words. He was writing to James Burkett, March 1st, 1755. And he says, in my late journey, I saw an instance of a very great quantity of lightning conducted by a wire no bigger than a common knitting needle. It was a Newbury in New England, where the spire of the church steeple, being 70 foot in height above the belfry, was split all to pieces and thrown about the street in fragments, from the bell down to the clock placed in the steeple 20 feet below the bell. There was the small wire above mentioned, which communicated the motion for the clock to the hammer striking the hour on the bell. As far as the wire extended, no part of the steeple was hurt by the lightning, nor the steeple, surprisingly. And he signed his correspondence, "Excuse this scrawl, which I have not time to copy fair. B. Franklin." So it's true. And we've brought up some of the treasures from the steeple and weathercock to share with you today. You can see on your way out of the sanctuary this morning one of the original acorns that frames the top of the steeple. The acorns, which had been wood with its most recent renovation, are now fiberglass. So the acorn that is right by the door there is one of the originals, and it is wood. We also have the mold that is to my right on the back of the weathercock that currently sits proudly atop the steeple. So this was used from the original, and then we created what is now atop of our steeple. And finally, we have two pieces of the clock that Benjamin Franklin referred to, including the hour hand piece, which he referenced, and those are on the left side up here. My biggest question, and I didn't get an answer to this, if anyone knows it, please share, why was there only an hour clock on the clock, an hour hand? Was that just what happened at that time? But there was no minute hand. It was only an hour hand. The truly invaluable thing about this steeple, however, the really meaningful thing, is the influence that it has on people. So whether it be a guiding light for a shipwrecked Frenchman, or a source of beauty for a 20th century businessman and his son, our steeple and this church are iconic. The Bulletin of the Society for the Preservation of New England Antiquities said it best in their issue from 1947, and I quote, "It is not alone a possession belonging to the church itself, but rather one in which every individual in the community can and does share." This church is an integral part of the fabric of this community and this region. May we steward it with care and hold open our doors so that all who seek it find solace, inspiration, and home. Amen and blessed be.
We hope you enjoyed this FRSNU podcast with Reverend Rebecca. To explore today's topic more deeply, consider the following questions. How does learning about history help you? What architecture is beautiful to you? How do you honor those who died in active service to our country? We'll be posting more FRSNU podcasts with Reverend Rebecca on our website, frsuu.org, and on our Facebook page. We'd love to see you in person at our services every Sunday morning at 10:30 at the First Religious Society Unitarian Universalist, located at 26 Pleasant Street in Newburyport. Or you can reach out to me, Nicole Salemi, Director of Community Engagement. Email me at nicole.salemi, that's Salem with an I, S-A-L-E-M-I, at frsuu.org. It has been good to be together.